Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today, very special guest. We're talking with an old friend and even a colleague of mine, Eric Townsend, private investor now and world traveler. Eric, it's a real pleasure to be talking to you again.
Chris, it's fantastic to be back on the show with you. Last time we did this was 2008.
Has it been that long?
Yeah, I think it has.
It has, and I think you were even here. You were here on the premises.
I was interviewing you at the time, and now we're turning the tables.
Absolutely. So, 2008, fill me in. What have you been up to?
Well, it's been quite a long time. I think you've got a lot of new listeners. So for people who don't realize, back in 2008, we didn't have a completed crash course, and a lot of us were just on the edge of our seats waiting for the next chapter to come out. And when Chapter 20 finally came out, a lot of people kind of took a step back and said, okay, what does this whole thing mean to me? And I remember meeting you back then. One of the things that was most striking to me is you and your family have never, run away in panic and thought the world was coming to an end. You've said, okay, look at what's coming. What does this mean to me? And how do I improve my life now? Not, compromises or sacrifices, but leading a better, more fulfilling life. And in your case, that was embracing resilience in your life. My life's a bit different from yours. So for me, I focused more on agility than resilience. I don't really want to live in one place in Western Massachusetts for the rest of my life. I'm kind of a world explorer kind of guy. And I frankly also, as I looked at the crash course and I thought about it and looked at all the people that were focusing their efforts on preparing for something bad happening in the world, it seems to me that most of the problems that have happened in history, whether it was the Holocaust or the collapse of the Soviet Union or what have you, all involved people getting out of harm's way. So I started focusing more on agility and just diversifying my plans. So I still have a house on the coast of Maine, but I wanted to start looking outside the country in case the U.S. falls apart. Where else would I go? And I thought, well, if the U.S. falls apart, I would just go someplace else. And I thought, wait a minute, if the U.S. was falling apart, that might be during a peak era. We're going and researching other places to live. Could be prohibitively expensive for anyone on any budget. And so what I've done for the last few years is really focus on living outside the U.S. and exploring the world, and with an eye towards what peak oil will bring us, what I think will happen to the U.S. economy, just looking at what our options are, where we might live for the rest of our lives, and will we come back to the U.S. or not, still undecided. But I've been living in Hong Kong the last couple of years, and for the last year and a half, my girlfriend and I have been essentially on a massive trip around the world, not panicking, thinking the world's coming to an end, but really enjoying ourselves, seeing the world, and considering what different places have to offer and where we might live in the long run. And a lot of this was inspired, really, by the work that you did in the crash course. So I'm going to be doing a whole interview on Financial Sense next month about this search for greener pastures, the trip around the world, looking at different countries and what they offer as we consider living inside the United States. So we probably ought to leave that there for now. And I know you wanted to focus on the macro picture, so maybe we should move on to that.
Well, without stealing any of that thunder, where are we finding you right now?
Right now I'm in New Zealand, Wellington, New Zealand.
And what are you noticing there in terms of, say, inflation or the cost of living from your perspective?
Wow. Holy cow, Chris. This is something for me. I've studied this. I've studied your work. I saw a lot of other people studying the effects of inflation. You can understand it in your mind conceptually. But when you travel to other parts of the world where their economies are still strong and the effects of inflation have not been delayed, which is what I believe is happening in the United States, you really feel it. We were in Melbourne, Australia a week ago. We went out to dinner, and it wasn't really a super fancy pants place. It was a fairly middle-of-the-road casual dining restaurant. And I looked at the left of the menu, and I thought, boy, this heirloom tomato salad looks delicious. I'm going to have that, and I'll just have the chicken pot pie for dinner. That's a nice, modest, comfortable meal. The heirloom tomato salad was 29 Australian dollars, about 31 U.S. dollars.
Oh.
And the chicken pot pie, Chris, was 53 Australian, 57 U.S. dollars. And I'm telling you, I don't care how much you have studied this and understand the implications of inflation on a logical or theoretical level, when you find yourself sitting in front of a $57 chicken pot pie, holy cow, something is going on. And I think what this is the inflation that's been exported from the United States through quantitative easing has pushed up prices of everything every place else. The U.S. economy is still in such a slump that we haven't really felt that big price shock yet. But it's coming, and it's really affected a lot of the world very harshly.
Well, I think this is a perfect illustration, that $57 chicken pot pie, of the macro story that we need to talk about. Because what the U.S. has been doing, and it's a plan, it's a strategy. Forget all the talk about we support a strong dollar, too, and all that other stuff. It's not true. The only way out for the U.S., like many countries, is to devalue its currency. And we've been doing that rather aggressively through QE, and we've been exporting that inflation. I love the chicken pot pie story because when we get to a place like China, where people are living on $290 a month or something like that, if they're doing well, working at Foxconn, building iPads or something like that, $290 a month, well, all of a sudden, you know, when you take $290 and you compare it to a $57 chicken pot pie, you understand that, you know, the exporting of inflation has really dramatic impacts on people from countries where they're not earning huge, wonderful, you know, multi-tens of thousands of dollar salaries. And the impact on those people, they often do not take it lightly. It's very serious business when your way of life is being eroded and really taken out day by day through this exporting of inflation. So that's where I think that's part of the lens that's really important to get, you know, your observations and anecdotes out around. Because when China, we read in the paper and the Chinese finance minister says, we're really not comfortable with all this money printing you're doing, there's another story under all of that, which is illustrated in what you just said, I think.
Yeah, and I think something that I've seen that nobody seems to be talking about is I think China has quite a bit of pull here, in that as QE happens, and I'm convinced it's going to happen sometime this year, I don't know when, it's going to export so much inflation to China that it's going to be almost intolerable for them. And I think that we're forgetting that if China says, okay, guys, we've had enough of this, if you do any more QE, we're going to dump the U.S. Treasury bonds that we're holding, and we're going to use the money to save our own economy. If we see that kind of reaction from China, it really could put a monkey wrench into the plans of the central banks to inflate this away. And I think that, you know, whether it's that mechanism or another one, at some point we're going to get to a hard wall here where you can't just print money forever without the unintended consequences coming back and biting you. I just described one mechanism that might cause the unintended consequence to create a feedback loop that comes back and bites the central bank, so they have to stop what they're doing, changing everything. Now, that might not happen, but there's a dozen others that you can think of in terms of mechanisms that might cause a sudden stop in quantitative easing. And if that happens, we're really going to see a roller coaster ride in the economy.
Okay, well then, in order to gauge that risk, let's back up a tiny bit. You say you think QE is likely. That's your assessment. Why do you hold that view?
Well, I think it's just, what else are they going to do? As far as I can tell, this whole economy propped up by stimulus and money printing really since 2009. And I think that what's going on is we've forgotten that we're literally changing the, I don't know if you want to call it changing the terminology or changing the paradigm, but what's going on here is we used to use words like solution fairly accurately. Now, as we're just creating these Band-Aid fixes to temporarily put symptoms of problems at bay, we're calling those solutions, and we're actually behaving, and when I say we, I mean collectively market participants are behaving now as if the ECB printing money in order to buy some more Greek bonds and put a bid under that market was a solution to the European sovereign debt crisis, and obviously nonsense. The ECB printing money just dilutes the value of the euro and causes more reason in the long term for people to flee away from making investments in euro-denominated sovereign debt. So it doesn't solve anything. But we've gotten to the point where we're so overwhelmed that the market is thinking in terms of these Band-Aid patches as being actual solutions to problems. And I think as long as that's the case, we're going to continue to employ these Band-Aid patches, which are things like printing more money, until it all comes to a head. When it comes to a head and how it comes to a head, I don't think anybody is smart enough to predict accurately. I just laid out one scenario which could cause it to happen. There's probably dozens more. At some point, though, we're going to get to a point where we can't handle any more printed money. And I think that the black swans that have been leaving the market alone for several years are going to come in force. And, you know, it was interesting to me to listen to Jim Poplava's outlook at the beginning of the year, because on the one hand, he's looking at the same information as I am. On the other hand, he comes to a very different conclusion. And for anyone who doesn't follow Financial Sense, Jim basically said, look, you know, leading economic indicators are all turning up. There's some black swans out there that you got to look out for. But as long as the black swans leave us alone, we're going to have really a positive up year in the stock market in 2012. Everything's looking good. LEIs are looking good. It's going to be great. And the way I would look at it would be almost the same, but with a very different conclusion. I think that Jim's right that if you ignore all the macro data, which is what the markets are doing now, the stock market is trading cyclically, and it's ignoring all of these structural risks. It's going to keep trading higher, because as long as you keep printing money and keep, you know, papering over these major structural problems, you'll continue to see growth in equities. But where have these black swans been? I think they're in Jim's neck of the woods, but not hanging out with Jim studying Austrian economics. I think the black swans have been at NAS Miramar in Top Gun training. That noise you heard when MF Global blew up on Halloween, I think that was an echo of the Black Swan Aggressor Squadron departing Miramar. They're on their tanker now, getting fuel, ready to take down the global economy. And, I mean, it just blows my mind. I don't think that we've ever seen a larger basket of major macro structural risks that everybody's aware of. It's not like nobody sees these things. But we've just somehow put them on the back burner. You know, don't worry about China. Don't worry about Europe blowing up. Don't worry about Iran. Don't worry about the carry trade unwind in Japan that you've just written about recently. Don't worry about peak oil. Don't worry about the domino effect of China and Japan going down, taking out other economies that depend on them. Certainly Australia is one of those, the place we just visited. Don't worry about $120 Brent. It's all fine. The LEIs are looking up. And we just seem to be in this cyclical trading mindset that's going to continue to last until something breaks. And I think that when something breaks, it's going to break big.
This thing breaking big, I'm interested, though, when you say the markets are trading higher cyclically and ignoring these major structural risks. I have this very confusing sort of an outlook, which is I don't always trust the markets anymore. I don't know that they're telling us useful information. And so right on the front page of, I believe it was yesterday's Wall Street Journal. So here it is. It's Thursday, February, what is it today? The 22nd. Yesterday's Wall Street Journal, they said, gosh, isn't this we have a strange phenomenon we'd like to discuss with you here. The Russell 2000, just a percent or two away from all-time highs. It's up 38% this year. It's up like this huge amount over the past year. And wouldn't you know it, money flows from retail investors have been negative every single month through that entire run. What's going on? Because normally the retail investors are piling in, or they've been piling in, or they're providing some of that fuel. Not only have they not been providing fuel, they've been subtracting fuel from that. Who's buying the Rusty? If we have all these people selling who are the retail investors, it means the market is no longer really made up, I guess, or is sensitive to you know, the retail investors. And how do you interpret that information?
You know, I don't pretend to understand how it all works, but I think that we're in an election year, and somehow, some way, the Obama administration is able to influence a lot of things, including the Fed that's supposedly independent but doesn't really appear to be, in my estimation. And I think the agenda here is all about propping up markets and general sentiment in the country in advance of the election. And I think the big thing that they seem to be wrestling with is you can't quite please all the people all the time. There's no good way to prop up the markets by printing money and printed government money to put a bid under everything, because if you do that, you blow oil prices through the roof, and that's going to cripple the economy. Okay, we need a scapegoat for the oil prices. Let's get ready to do something. You know, we're going to get ready to rumble with Iran here. We're going to make them the bad guys somehow for the fact that oil prices are going up. I see an overall agenda that's about propping up markets, however it is that they do it, through money printing and influencing the media and whatever else is going on. And it's all about, from now to election, everything's got to be all roses. And I think that that's what's driving this, and I think the strategy is probably, and I'm not saying I think this is going to work, because I think it could all come tumbling down before it gets to this, but I think that the strategy of whoever is pulling the strings on these puppets is if we can get to a new all-time high on the Dow, which is only about 9% away from what it is right now today, we'll be able to lure retail back into the stock market, and we can maybe get another bump from there. It'll all come crashing down at some point when the macro kicks in and people get in touch with reality again. But if we can somehow prop things up just a little further, we can get retail suckered back into the market. And I think that what's going on is probably they're not seeing that happening. The people who would like to make that happen are influencing others in order to do these potentially non-economic trades in order to bump up the value of indices to get to new all-time highs. You're seeing it with the Russell, and I think you'll see it in the next few months with the Dow, assuming they're able to keep this party going. I just don't understand why it seems like the bulk of investors are not dealing in reality mode with Europe. You look at what's going on in Europe, nobody's talking about a real solution to any problem. They're talking about short-term Band-Aid fixes that'll last a few months at best. And it all has to blow up at some point, and nobody seems to be taking it seriously. I just don't know what to make of it.
You know, it's very interesting to me, in my position, you note that they're quite probably, and I'm almost 100% convinced this is true, doing everything they can to keep asset prices inflated. The Fed has even written op-eds in the Wall Street Journal, penned by Bernanke ostensibly, maybe as a ghostwriter, but saying, you know, we're very happy, wink, wink, that the stock market continues to go up as we dump money into it. So clearly it's part of the agenda to keep the markets going up. The mysterious part to me is how they've managed to shoot themselves in the foot. So I don't think these are a bunch of really super clever guys and gals who've managed to figure out how to rig markets to the upside. Because what did they do with MF Global? They sucked more confidence out of the market by failing to pursue that aggressively in favor of the retail investor, of the small person. You know, they let big cats skate on what is inarguably just theft and fraud. There's just really no other way to term it at this point in time. And all the while pretending, throwing their hands up like it's too complicated to unravel. Where did the money go? We don't know. You know, as if money could actually disappear in our system. It can't. Unless you put it on pallets and bring it into Baghdad Airport, it's all traceable and trackable. So it's just crazy to me, this idea that one of the things that we really do need, I agree with your thesis, we really need, if we want the markets to really power higher, we need retail to come back in. In my position, I get to work with people who saw that, interpreted it correctly for what it is, who are now scared of any brokerage, possibly rightly so, really questioning whether they even want their money in the U.S. or whether it needs to be in any brokerage at all, or what do we do? And it just adds to this general pervasive sense of fear and uncertainty in the markets. And I'm not talking about, you know, average people who have 401ks who look at them once a year. I'm talking about very professional, active money managers are in a state of confusion, uncertainty, surprise, shock around what's going on, you know, with MF Global being literally a symptom. There are dozens of other things we can point to that all collectively say this system is really in trouble. And the people who are ostensibly in charge of it seem not to be aware of the magnitude of allowing that rot to continue without being addressed on some fundamental basis.
Oh, I agree completely. And, you know, I think there's a very simplistic thing at play here. It's not a high-tech concept, but I think that people in general go through these social moods. And for all of our lifetimes, recessions have always lasted for 2 or 3 years at most. It's time for this to be over on everybody's mental clock.
Mm-hmm.
Now, people like you and I look at this and say, no, actually, you know, there are good examples when the structural macro factors were this far out of whack. The Great Depression lasted 10 years. Most people don't experience life that way. Most people say, well, I've been through the 1982, 83 recession. I remember it was 2 or 3 really hard years. Then it all got better. I think that everybody just has it in their gut that it's time now for things to get better. And they will just interpret almost anything with a bias towards, well, it's the end of this. It's all over now. And you saw this in the Great Depression. There was a big move down. It looked like everything was recovering, maybe even moving back towards all-time highs. Then you saw the bigger, deeper downturn when people realized, no, we haven't solved any of the structural problems that got us here. There is no, pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. We've got to deal with our problems before it gets better. And I think we're coming up to that point where we realize No, it's not getting better. It's time to deal with the problems, and we haven't done anything since 2008 to deal with any of the structural problems in the economy. All we've done, and all of our political leaders have done, is to paper over short-term problems with Band-Aid fixes that don't solve anything. And I think, as you've said many times, and some of the other, you know, a few commentators on the Internet have pointed out, our political leadership doesn't understand the problem. They misdiagnosed a solvency crisis for a liquidity crisis, and they keep not understanding why yet another liquidity injection hasn't solved the problem. It's not ever going to solve the problem, and we're not going to get to a solution until we get to an accurate diagnosis, and I don't think we're there yet.
Oh, I agree, and the risk here is that the longer we have the misdiagnosis, the more we're going to be applying the wrong medicine. And you mentioned that we haven't really solved anything. I'll go further and say that I see more derivatives in the system since 2008. There is a higher level of aggregate debt across the globe. It's been transferred certainly from private into public balance sheets, but there it is. So we've really just been trying more of the same. And if it turns out that that's the wrong diagnosis, that in fact the ailment was too much debt, adding more liquidity and not addressing solvency and adding more debt is really adding, you know, making the situation worse. And so I see all of these things, the risks, right? So we add more derivatives and they're more complicated and we don't really know who the counterparties are. And I mean that honestly. I don't think anybody has a handle on that. And we're just adding more and more debt. We're just, you know, pushing it from here to there. So the ECB owns it now instead of a few private investors in Greece, whatever. It's still debt in the system. And I want to cycle back. So you mentioned, you know, we have potentially this squadron of black swans taken off from Miramar. Let's talk about some of these black swans, because in my mind, it won't take much, really. It could just take like a dark brown swan at this point. It wouldn't take much to spook the system. And there's so many things out there that could be potential candidates here in 2012. So what are the big black swans on your radar screen? Maybe if we could start, we talked about Europe a little bit. Do you see Europe as a potential black swan, or is that a known quantity at this point?
Well, I think that what's most likely in my mind is that we will continue to delude ourselves. They will probably come up with some kind of, and I use the word solution in quotes, another solution will be announced. A deal will be announced that is a stay of execution on Greece for a few more months. And I think that the U.S. administration will do anything it can to influence getting the ultimate blow-up of Europe to be somehow delayed until after the November elections in the U.S. At some point, though, I think that Europe comes back and finally blows up on us. Maybe that won't be till next year. You know, as much as I am absolutely resolute that there is no solution to any real problem and can be no solution, there are plenty of ways that you can paper this over and do a Band-Aid fix that lasts a few more months. And I think they'll probably continue doing that through most of 2012. Iran's another story, and my gut on Iran is that it, at this point, is a strategic tool. They know they're going to fight with Iran at some point. They know that Obama is not going to win the election in November with $150 oil prices and $7 gasoline, if it comes to that, unless there's a good scapegoat. So everybody can feel like, you know, the president's doing the right thing in order to fix this problem that people like that don't look like us created. Must be all Iran's fault. I don't know exactly how it's going to go down, but I have the sense that the Iranians know this, because there was a very, it seemed to me, smooth process that went along. You know, some saber rattling with Iran, then kind of a delay. We're going to wait 6 months, and you guys in Iran, you better watch out, because in 6 months we're going to really put the screws to you. Iran has come back and said, look, you want to rumble? We don't want to wait. We're going to shut off the oil to Europe right now. We're going to push this. And the only reason I could possibly imagine that the Iranians would bring outside pressure, potentially military pressure on them, is that they're playing a poker game. They know that it's much better for them to force this issue at a time when the U.S. doesn't want to deal with it, as opposed to fighting with the U.S. at a time when the U.S. does want to deal with it. So I think it would be very interesting to see if Iran is able to push the West's buttons in order to bring this conflict to a head sooner than the West would have liked to have dealt with it. My gut is that what the Obama administration would have liked is to keep Iran kind of on hold, at bay, not really getting into any direct military conflict, and wait until it's almost time for the election. Let at that point, gas prices are spiking. You're blaming speculators, and you're blaming Iran, and the president is making military action in order to bring gas prices back down. Most people buy that story, feel good about it, and in a time of recently initiated war, the incumbent usually gets reelected because everybody is feeling a sense of dedication or loyalty to the patriotism of whatever's going on. The times when wars tend to not get incumbents reelected is when they're old wars that everybody feels should have been over by now. So I think they want fresh conflict Iran around the time of the election, and I don't think they'll be able to hold it off that long. I think the Iranians are going to basically push the issue and say we have to deal with it.
Well, the U.S. has not been sitting idly by sort of waiting for a better time. If you've been following what we've been doing to them economically and financially, if they were in reverse being conducted by Iran against the U.S., everybody would consider them acts of war. There are these goadings, little stick pokings at the hornet's nest, as it were. And I don't know what they're meant to accomplish besides to let Iran know that we're there and we're watching and we're very interested in them doing something differently. And so here's the thing. I've read a number of analyses on this at this point, and it turns out that this would be a pretty tall order for Israel all on its own to take care of business. So let's assume for the moment that taking care of business means some bombing campaign is conducted and Iran's nuclear ambitions are scuttled as a consequence of that. Well, first of all, you can't really know what the effectiveness of a bombing campaign is until you get on the ground to look at it. And second of all, it's a pretty tall order given the hardened nature of the specific sites. There are three. Israel only has so many planes. They only have so many weapons. And long story short, it seems unlikely that Israel could conduct this all on its own without significant U.S. support in some way. Active direct military support. So here's the U.S. It's very interestingly, been poking at Iran. And I think you're right. If Iran has any advantage at all, it's to control the timetable of this a little bit. You know, it was funny. Europe was like, in July, we're going to stop buying fuel from you. Like, well, it's warm then, and you're suffering through one of the coldest winters on record. That I'm sure that works for you pretty well, But Iran, I think, if they're going to exert any influence on this, is going to say, how about now? How about February? How does that work for you? And so there is this game going on, and we've seen multiple iterations of this game. This is the third or fourth time I've seen the saber rattling with Iran. What makes it different this time in your mind than the other three, which essentially led to no conflict?
Well, what I see that really is different, if you look at, there was a lot of saber rattling right early first week of January or so. And it seemed like the U.S. was going to try to push an actual military action to happen in Iran soon. Then we saw this backing off where they kind of said, well, that threat of embargo, we're going to delay that by 6 months. And it seemed like somehow between the U.S. and Europe, they changed their mind and they wanted to delay the interaction with Iran. Now Iran is saying, well, wait a minute, if you're going to threaten to embargo our oil in 6 months, we're going to stop selling it to you now, and we're going to find another buyer now. I think that that's causing the U.S. and Europe also to come back and say, okay, we got to deal with this now. I agree that the actions against Iran have been acts of war, that so far they have not responded with violence to, but I think that they will soon. What I see, though, is maybe the ability of the West to manage this as well as they wanted to. I sort of, what was that movie about producing the war, where they just wanted to create the public, Wag the Dog, the movie about the war being produced for public consumption. Seems like Iran's not going to play that game. They're going to change the timetables, even in a way by bringing some pressure on themselves earlier than most people thought they would. They're going to keep throwing a monkey wrench into the work. I think it's looking to me like it's going to come to a head sooner rather than later. But we'll see what happens. And the thing is, $200 crude oil is very likely if we see an eruption of a full conflict in Iran. That will cripple the global economy. I don't care what the pundits are saying or how long the market continues to rally. Eventually, the cost of energy will prevent the productive economy from functioning profitably and growing. And it's got to come sooner or later.
So $200 oil is a likely outcome if we attack Iran. That's certainly a black swan. Let's shift pretty much all the way across the globe. China, do you see any risks there?
I think that QE3 and actually the QE that's already going on from the LTRO operations in Europe is exporting so much inflation to China that they're not going to be able to tolerate it. And the big risk in China is food price inflation. You don't have a democracy, so the leaders there don't have to worry about getting reelected. What they do have to worry about is food riots. And they run their economy on a pretty fine line. They're just a little ways away from food prices getting to the point where people cannot afford to feed their families. And that's when you get major unrest in China. I think that that could happen as a result of QE3 and more quantitative easing around the world, the rest of the world getting into essentially a major round in the competitive devaluation agenda that so many Western nations have of printing more and more money to dilute the value of their own currencies. This all has the effect of increasing the cost of food in China. And when that happens, I think at some point, China has a fair amount of leverage, because if they were to say to the U.S., look, we can't tolerate this QE you guys keep doing. You got to cut it out or we're going to dump all of our treasury holdings. The U.S. cannot allow China to dump all of its treasury holdings. And I think, you wrote recently about changing the rules. I think that the treasury market is going to be the place where we see the most profound changing of rules. I think that suddenly people who bought things that they thought were saleable in the open market find out that certain categories of investors get restricted and limited from liquidating their holdings. You have to, do this over time, or something changes, or the rules change under the threat of conditional default that make it harder for people like China to just dump their treasury holdings. China wouldn't react well to that or any kind of threat along those lines. China would potentially ratchet up the trade tension that already exists between China and the West. And I think you're just looking at a potential for a whole calamity which by itself could take down the global economy just in China's reaction. You also have to remember that China and Japan both are really in very tenuous circumstances. You wrote about Japan recently and the effects of the carry trade unwind. But look at like Australia. Now, Australia, we just came from there, is their economy is still booming. It feels like 2006 United States when you visit Australia. The employment is good. The economy is good. Everybody's happy. Everything's going strong. Restaurants are busy. It's just cranking along. Well, 47% of Australian GDP is exports of coal and iron ore to Japan and China. So what if China and Japan both get into major economic dislocations? You could take an Australian economy over. And what does that do? Where are all of these trickle-down effects? And how many different parts of the global economy suddenly get taken down when one viral event happens? And I think that between Japan, China, and Europe, we're looking at a huge, huge macro risk before you consider the whole Iran thing. So I just think that the overall picture is more ominous than I've ever seen before, and at the same time we're seeing the equity markets ignore it to a greater degree than we've ever seen before, and I just don't know what to make of it.
Well, that is a disconnect, and the larger disconnect, which you just framed very nicely, which has been bothering me for a while, is I look at Japan and I see a country that's teetering. You know, they're not over the impact of the tsunami. They've got, I think, 52 of 54 of their nuclear reactors are in shutdown. They're limping through a severe power shortage at this point in time. It will get more exacerbated this summer. They've just become, for the first time in 31 years, an export deficit nation, meaning that their trade deficit is now in negative territory. And they need an incredible amount of money flowing into the country to satisfy the outrageous levels of deficit spending that they're undergoing, because they're still engaged in what effectively is a pretty monstrous QE program, and they're trying to weaken the yen and printing and doing all of these things. So I see Japan as fairly weak. Well, you put all that together, the last thing Japan needs in this situation would be $200 a barrel oil. The last thing the entire world needs is $200 a barrel oil, except for maybe some thin political benefits that would accrue to certain incumbents and whatnot. Really high oil prices coming from a conflict like that certainly is no help to anybody, not the debt markets, not the financial markets, not the rickety countries that are now teetering, none of that. So it's just mysterious to me when I look at it. I'm like, really? Iran now? Now's a good time? Because we have been goading Iran in ways which they could react and say, that's it. You know, we've had it. We're tired of being poked. Here's our response, and it's military. That would not be unthinkable. So I don't understand the calculus being applied there. It's odd to me. And just as odd is this disconnect between whatever the equity markets apparently are looking at and what I'm looking at. At on a risk-adjusted basis, I don't see much there that's really compelling in the stock markets, but maybe that's the key term here. With interest rates at 0%, just put your CalPERS hat on a minute. You're the largest pension fund in the country, right, in the U.S., so you're the California Pension and Retirement System. CalPERS is sitting there, and they've got to get 7.75% stated return year after year, or they fall into an actuarial compounding black hole. And they're getting exactly what from bonds at this point in time on an average yield? 2% maybe? 3? Something like that? And across their entire bond portfolio? So how do you make up the difference?
Well, and what I think is even more striking is not just the fiscal black hole that's ahead of them, but if you were looking at a problem like that intelligently, then what would happen is CalPERS, you know, trustees would be out saying, look, we need a public conversation in the state of California about what we're going to do here, because we haven't fallen into this hole yet, but it's in front of us, and we can't create a bridge over it. We're going to go down this hole at least a certain depth. We Californians need to come together and decide what we're going to do with the available resources that we do have, rather than just lying to ourselves about a fantasy that's never going to happen. But nothing remotely like that is happening. And as you see, all of these major structural risks that face the entire global economy, none of the governments in question are doing the necessary work to say, okay, it's time to face the music, folks. This is what we're dealing with. This is what it looks like. What's going to happen? This leads me back to your earlier comment about, if the problem here is too much debt, how could anybody in their right mind possibly think that adding more debt is going to solve the problem? Well, I have a hypothesis for you, Chris, for how maybe that makes sense to some people.
Okay.
And it all rests in your recent article about changing the rules. What if the purpose of the new debt was to rearrange who has the debt, who's holding the debt, and what form it's being held in, so that we can have a major unprecedented round of changing the rules to redistribute wealth in a way that would have been previously unheard of? Well, look at, as an example, what's happened to civil rights in the United States since 9/11, with between the Patriot Act and FISA and the HIRE Act, now NDAA, where you have the government given the essentially unlimited authority to lock people up, throw away the key without ever pressing charges, your right to trial by jury and speedy trial and confrontation of your accuser. All that stuff is out the window. Forget the Constitution. We're making new rules because we've got to fight terrorism. Well, look at the magnitude of the macro event, the major global economic dislocation that you and I both see on the horizon. If 9/11, which was two buildings and a few thousand people losing their lives, could allow us to throw out our Constitution, then I think a major macro, you know, a major global economic dislocation could easily allow us to throw out the rule of contract law and simply say governments are in charge of redefining who has all the wealth, who has the assets. This whole thing's going to get reset, and we're going to go to a global currency while we do that. If your agenda was to cause that big picture outcome over the next few years, wouldn't you want to be redefining the debt and put more of the debt off of the private books onto the public books, where the government has more direct control over what the terms and conditions of those instruments are?
Well, I certainly think I would. And, you know, there was a director of PIMCO maybe 4 or 5 years ago postulated that one easy way to sort of solve the big external indebtedness problems of the U.S., but also other countries, was to simply not, you know, create two classes. Are you an internal holder of my sovereign debt or an external holder? Sorry about you, external holders. I mean, it was a legitimate thought piece from a very big bond firm, which was saying, you know, we could just sort of have one of these enforced international jubilee kind of a things. If you're going to go down that route, I think, Well, what does it really matter? So this is something I don't know that some deflationists really internalize as a possibility, but if the Fed's holding a trillion European bonds and the Europeans are holding a trillion U.S. bonds and they both just wink at each other and cancel them off their books, what just happened?
Well, I think that the question in my mind is, if you were trying to put the government in a position to redefine who gets what wealth according to their own crony standards, you would want to create exactly this kind of situation where you can create a crisis that's so bad that you have to do something dire, and then you take over with force majeure and the government's in charge of handing it all out. I wouldn't see the U.S. and Europe both nod, nod, wink, wink, let's just cancel out both of our debts. What I would see them doing is saying, let's continue to rack these things up so that we have more and more chips that we can push around and change the rules with. And so I guess I'm not following where you're going with the U.S. and Europe just canceling each other out.
Well, my point is that once a central bank takes an asset onto its books, there's really nothing that says it has to then get it back off its books by selling it into the open market. It can just let it expire there if it wants to. And what just happened? Nothing. The money stays out in the economy, and the debt, or even if it's not a bad debt, whatever debt it was, just went away. It's entirely possible to have these bad assets go into central bank vaults, if you will, onto their balance sheet and just evaporate there and disappear. It's something. It's a possibility. And if it's either that, or you know, we face the possibility of a system-wide systemic failure that drags entire countries down and plunges the world into darkness and war, sure, they'll do this other thing, which is just, it's just printing. I'm just making my oldest argument, which I've been carrying as my main investment thesis, which is, of the possible outcomes that are lying before us here, the easiest one to stomach, I think, both temporally, politically, from a career standpoint for most of the involved individuals, is to just print a little more and you know, buy up the bad debts as they come available and just stuff them away and I think make them go away in their minds. It's you know, what happened to the Bear Stearns books that the Fed took on? The Maiden Lane, they've just been winding that stuff down. I don't know what's happening to it, but, you know, it's just sort of been evaporating off of sublimating off of the Federal Reserve balance sheet. To me, that seems like the preferred strategy at this point.
And I think that's exactly what I was alluding to is, you know, you start with something like Maiden Lane. You tell the taxpayers, look, we're buying this stuff up. It's not really a bailout. We're just transferring it from a private to a public balance sheet. But don't worry, it's not a bailout. We're just buying this stuff for what it's worth. Well, of course, they're actually paying 10 times more than it's worth. And then eventually it gets sublimated off of the Fed's balance sheet. I like that expression. In a way that nobody ever really finds out that, no, that was a bailout. You were just taking the bankers who paid you a lot of campaign money, and you were repaying that favor by buying stuff that was worth nothing at par and sticking it on the public balance sheet where it eventually would be kind of forgotten about through this process you're describing. And I think that's exactly what I'm saying about redistribution of wealth. What would it mean in a capitalist system if we were to allow the system to reset itself? Well, it would mean all the banks that took these, you know, extended a ridiculous amount of credit against lousy collateral, they would actually go bankrupt because they made some bad bets. We're saying, no, we're not going to do it that way. We're going to buy those bad bets for them at par. We're going to bail the banks out, put the government in the position where it has taken all of the losses that should have been taken by the private sector, and then we're going to find a way to make that go away so nobody notices what happened. And that's exactly where I see this all going, is the cronyism is going to continue. The people who are best connected are going to have their interests protected through fairly complex and unobvious mechanisms that allow the government to take the debt out of the private sector, the bad debt that should stay there, where people should be punished for having made those bad loans in the first place. They're going to come off scot-free, and ultimately it's the middle class and the taxpayer that's going to eat the cost of this, and it will happen in very complex and unobvious ways so that most people can't figure out what happened to them.
Well, not one man in a million can diagnose inflation, sort of an altered Keynes quote right there. And this will result in inflation, and it has to at some point in my mind, because ultimately what we're talking about, whether it's the Maiden Lane, you know, we're getting down to the minutiae and we're discussing the complexity of it, or any of these other things with the complicated acronyms, what's happening here is that somebody went into an incredible amount of debt That debt resulted, like all debt does, in an equal and offsetting amount of money. That's out there doing things. It built subdivisions. It bought yachts. It took trips. It did stuff. But the debt remained, and then the debt starts to go bad, and the Federal Reserve buys that, or some other central bank, or the government itself buys that, and takes that off and puts more money out into the system to purchase that debt. And so ultimately, we're just stuffing more and more and more money out there. And, this ultimately results in inflation. It hasn't yet in the official statistics very much, in the U.S. at least, but it certainly is going to at some point. And here's where, if we combine the two big theories out there, one is we're printing money like crazy because we think it's a liquidity crisis. So look at all these liquidity events. Central banks everywhere are doing it. Across the globe at this point in time. And then we take this other concept, which says that, well, wait a minute, the economy is actually real things. It's goods and services, tangible things I can point to, touch, receive, that's ultimately what this money is a marker for. Hey, how's that doing? And we look at where we are in the peak oil story. We look at $120+ Brent. We look at energy where it currently is, which is, of course, the number one substance for creating things economically. So I put these two big spheres together, and it's just everything that I've been doing, Eric, over all of these years in trying to talk about and warn people about these two big things that are happening. The money printing is a very natural human tendency that we can see historically, and it's happening before our very eyes today again, on the one hand. And then on the other hand, this idea that there are limited and limiting supplies of some very critical substances out there right now. And when we put those two pieces together, it's really a perfect storm for someday, sooner or later, for there to be just, in a very obvious way to all the participants, vastly more quantities of money out there than there are goods and services. Well, that's just inflation.
Well, and believe me, the inflation, it feels in some ways like it hasn't happened yet, but the inflation's already happened. The fact that there's already too much money in the system driving prices up is happening around the globe. It is magically suppressed in the United States, and part of that suppression is real prices are not increasing in the U.S. the way they are elsewhere. Part of it is the fuzzy numbers reporting. But when you find yourself sitting in front of a $57 pot pie, trust me, inflation is already happening.
It is indeed. And of course, one of the great sins of the U.S. central bank is to not have considered asset inflation a form of inflation. New Zealand, where you happen to be, their central bank does consider asset inflation inflation, and they control it carefully. I've always admired them for that. House price inflation, that's asset inflation. It's inflation as far as they're concerned. In the U.S., Greenspan, Bernanke, continuing the tradition, has thought, oh, no. Assets are different. We like asset inflation. And so in many ways, I'm looking at the stock market going up, and we might be tempted to feed that into our LEI machine and say, oh, well, the LEI is going up, and because it's going up, stocks are going up, and because stocks are going up, the LEI is going up. I love that little loop that it's got going. But if what the LEI is tracking is a stock market that is not going up for what we would call the right reasons, meaning it's really fundamentally a good value and that's what the price rise is signaling, but instead it's inflating. And it's inflating because there are really unattractive options out there in bond territory. Who wants to get 0% on their money? In fact, sometimes fiduciarily, certain trustees are prevented from chasing, either 0% yields or yields in bonds that are anything less than full investment grade. So their universe of things they can invest in shrinks, and so bang, off they go into stocks because there's really nowhere else to go. That's a very classic dynamic. I'm looking at the stock market going up and wondering how much of that is just the equivalent of inflation, and meaning that when we track the GDP, we track what's called the real GDP, not the nominal GDP. Nominal's the total number. But from that, we have to subtract inflation, because guess what? Inflation isn't real. And so we pull that out so we have an understanding of what's really happening. In my mind, things like part of the price of oil, part of the price of commodities today, part of the price of the college education I'm staring at for my 17-year-old in next year, part of what I'm seeing in my healthcare costs every year, part of what I'm seeing in the stock market are all just symptoms of this incredible amount of quantitative easing that's been going on.
Oh, absolutely. And, I think there's even just to strengthen the argument you already made, we can't forget that the whole definition of a recession versus a depression lies entirely on a contraction in GDP that lasts over a period of years. And the conventional definition is a 10% reduction in real GDP is a depression. if you were to use realistic inflation numbers, the GDP deflator that the BLS calculates, if you were to do that realistically, use, say, shadow stats numbers, you would find that we're in a bona fide depression, that we've been in a depression for a few years now. If you're honest with yourself and you recognize this is not the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, this is the next Great Depression, and it's happening around us right now. If you accept that, something that I is just a fact, and you look at what the prices are in the face of what is actually an economic depression, and we're still seeing, even in real terms, record numbers on prices on things like oil, something's going on here, and it is not sustainable now. You just wait till the economy starts to look like it's recovering, because it's completely unsustainable then.
Fascinating. You know, I have the sense you and I could talk about this for many more hours, and we've come up on the end of our time. So I want to reserve the right to continue this conversation before too much more time passes. And certainly if any black swan comes along, or even a dark brown or gray one, I hope you and I can talk about it.
Well, hey, it's always a pleasure, and I look forward to coming back, and we'll do part two when circumstances warrant.
Well, I bet they will soon. Have a happy 2012, and don't eat any $57 chicken pot pies on my behalf. Make sure you're really enjoying that when you tuck into it.
Well, it's not really possible for me to enjoy a $57 pot pie. I went through it as more of a learning experience about what is to come, and it's a sobering experience. So thanks very much for having me on, and I'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
All right, Eric, pleasure's been mine.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartenson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.